Greetings, everyone, and welcome to episode DRAW-RLM-003, and I am known as Craig. First, some important messages to convey to you before we get into the main topic of this episode. This being an RLM-centric presentation, I will take a moment here to ask you listening to consider donating to Real Liberty Media. On the front page of the Real Liberty Media website, you should be able to find a donate button there. I've said it once before, and I'll say it again. Moving forward into the future, I, for one, can foresee this platform as being one of the least censored platforms available on the interwebs for truly quality content, or content that is of a true quality. While we have access to the interwebs, that is. And in referring to content on the interwebs, should you be interested in finding my purposefully limited presence online, the best place to do so would be to go to my Linktree page. And to do that, I'll briefly recite the address for you. It is linktr.ee/A-R-T_OF_CRAIG_S. linktree/artofcraigs. Thank you for all the feedback concerning these presentations thus far. There has been a lot of encouragement and a few critiques. One such critique being the use of clips. Some folks would prefer to hear me talking than listening to clips. And how can I respond to all of that? Well, on one hand, thank you for the encouragement. And on the other, I find it necessary to include some third-party content in order to further expand upon some of the topics I'd like to discuss that are near and dear to me. And to conclude this introduction segment, as well as for the sake of Real Liberty Media, I will read aloud the following, which is a fair use disclaimer. Under Section 107 of the Copyright Act of 1976, allowance is made for fair use for purposes such as criticism, comment, news reporting, teaching, scholarship, and research. Fair use is a use permitted by copyright statute that might otherwise be infringing. Educational use tips the balance in favor of fair use. And to all of that, I'll add that I will be including my own opinions in a fair and favorable way to the third-party content, all of which relates to the topic at hand. The topic being inventiveness and creativity. Precisely put, appreciating and recognizing cerebral ingenuity, which are most important subjects to me in being a curious and creative person. So over the course of this episode, I will center the topic of inventiveness and creativity by way of focusing upon the paths of three such persons known worldwide. To be sure, there will be quite a few tangents along the way, and I'll do my best to rein in such asides and keep the presentation topical. The first such aside being naturally the Most High, our Heavenly Father, Jehovah, the Creator, the source of all of creation, however you wish to think of Him, He has created all things. And since creation, mankind certainly has delved into much of it. I think there is even more to discover yet. As well, there are some things mankind will just never know or discover. Because we simply aren't meant to, try as we may. And I endorse that reasoning because if one were to couple the psychopathic rulership of our species at this point in time, including mankind's collective apathy towards them, would anyone really want such people to have access to the very same capabilities as the Most High? Certainly not. In a sense, mankind doesn't really create or invent. We just rearrange what was already here. Anyways, moving on, in cobbling together this presentation, I had set out to piece together a collection of particular persons who have demonstrated a great cerebral capacity, who also talk about their inventive or creative process in their own words. The first of which is still alive, the second of which passed away some time ago, and the third of which, one of my favorite artists, passed away recently. There are two common threads pertaining to what we are going to hear from these three people. These recordings were made long after whatever it was that these people had invented or created that brought them so much notoriety and enriched our experience on this earthly plane of existence. Also, they are all in their later years of life at the time of these recordings or discussions or what have you, which is something to keep in mind. Its significance being that they had quite a great deal of time to reflect upon their respective paths in life. All the better for us, I suppose, as they share their respective experiences and wisdom. The first set of clips are from a student competition and discussion concentrated on the ever-popular Rubik's Cube, invented by Erno Rubik. Now, a few notes concerning Mr. Rubik from Wikipedia here. Erno Rubik is a Hungarian sculptor and professor of architecture who is best known for inventing the Rubik's Cube in 1974. By 1980, the Rubik's Cube was marketed throughout the world and over 1 million authorized units, with an estimated 50 million unauthorized imitations were sold, mostly during its subsequent 3 years of popularity. Today, it is one of the world's best-selling toys at 350 million units and counting. It proved a useful tool for teaching algebraic group theory, which was the inspiration behind Mr. Rubik creating this popular puzzle toy when he was a professor of architecture at the Budapest College of Applied Arts. Now, the following is one of four short clips that were part of a Q&A session from an event that was held in 2001 with Mr. Rubik.
What inspired you to make the Rubik's Cube, and why did you make it?
That's a question that is very easy to ask, and it's very difficult to answer. So that's a very typical one. And I got it several times. It's interesting why people are interested about this in this way. So, life is full of inspiration. It depends on you, which one you recognize and which one strong enough to move you on and starting with something. And usually it's the directions are not so clear at the beginning, but you can have some kind of intuition, imagination. You can dream of something and you can feel the value. The value is what we are running for, to achieve some different level of something, or you see the richness of the potential result and such a thing. But it takes time to achieve that. But gradually it's growing with success, partly, and failures and so on. That's a long, depend on the task, it's longer or shorter, but it takes time all the time. It takes time. So they are only, how can I say, fairy tales to think just to invent something is happen at once. Nothing. I don't believe that. I don't believe you can dream of one night and wake up in the morning and you find something and it's finished. So that's not the way. But it's a good beginning. And very shortly, that's it.
I appreciate how he said, quote, life is full of inspiration, unquote. And that he continued on to say that it depends on you and what propels you to develop a potential idea on your perception, is how I interpreted that. He certainly is revealing to us that he thinks like an artist, as well how he comments on how the process takes time. The inspiration for any idea may be instantaneous, but to bring an idea to fruition takes time. So let's hear some more from Mr. Rubik in this next clip.
What was the design process like when creating the cube? How did you come up with the solution?
with hard work. So that if she's a designer, so I'm sure she already familiar with this kind of process. Design is an activity based on our understanding about the needs of material, the potential of material, and the needs of people. And to put together the whole thing and fulfill the needs and optimize the process, and finally we can find a solution. And sometimes the solution is nothing else, just a slightly modified different thing that it existed before, or can be born something very original and new. The cube as an object, as a result of design, it's in one hand, it's ancient. Thousands of times, of years, people know the cube as a form, the geometrical one. It became a symbol of lots of things as a form. And what I did is nothing else, just put together elements of it, so divided, you can say, a big one to smaller pieces. The cube is very unique solid because it can fulfill space without gaps. No any other regular solid can do that. And so all of the pieces are identical and capable to fulfill space. That gives a potential of the feeling very variable and very so many different ways. But to do it in line, as we are doing it, if you are building from cubes in the kindergarten, you know, it's simple. So it's an addition, additional. With my structure, it's complex because the rule of changing the spaces, the space of the elements are closed, I can say. So it's not an open one. So it's not something like when you have a jigsaw puzzle and put together the pieces. Here they are scrambled and take away one, find the right place, put it there. Very easy to do. The only task is to find the right place for the right pieces. Here, the cube is doing this by itself, according our moves. So, and that was one idea. My idea was to have a puzzle, but you can't lose any piece. You know, it's a very disturbing if you have a puzzle and you are missing one of them. And other thing is as well, so keeping the rule the rule is built in to the product. So you don't need instruction sheets. Generally speaking, I hate very much instruction sheets because they are usually wrong. It's a very special type of task to write down how to use an object or an instrument or something like that. And there are so many failures on that. Here, is the third one is you don't need to define the goal. What is your goal? Usually, traditionally, the puzzles are take it apart and put it together type of thing. But here, the goal is very simple because if you get it, you see the final goal. It's ordered. And the simplest order that is possible because it's a similarity is one side, one color, that's all. And just not to be careful, we try to move it on, and after a few turns, we would like to come back. And we're facing the problem. And this problem became more and more serious because that's like in a labyrinth, you are not finding your way out, but you are going into deeper into a labyrinth. It's getting darker and darker, you know that. So that's very simple about the design form. The colors of the cube are coding. Coding is a very important thing in design. We are coding a lot of things. here, that was what I find the simplest way of coding because I thought the task itself, it's so difficult. If you are make it more difficult by learning the codes, it makes it more disturbing. So the simplest coding was what I found, it is the colors which are alive, and colors, it's connected, it's like, how can I say, it's part of life in my view, especially the bright colors. Thank you.
1% inspiration and 99% perspiration is an expression that comes to my mind from what Mr. Rubik had just stated there. He also spoke of the reoccurring pattern of the cube itself and that it was an ancient form, which piqued my interest because the Platonic solids certainly are that. And I'm highlighting this because it is this ability to keep in mind such motifs that allow one to take seemingly disparate ideas or things and to recombine them in a new way. This is the hallmark of this inventive and creative thinking. And with that, let's move on to the next clip, where Mr. Rubik astutely deconstructs the elements of problem solving in general. So listen carefully, please.
My task was try to understand the result of my doing. So I made a rigid object became flexible and changeable, and it was needed to discover what happened and how, what is the nature of the movement or the changes. So that's it, and that's what I can suggest to everyone thinking about a problem. The first thing is to facing with the problem. Try to understand what is the problem. Without that, you are not able to look any kind of solution. So, it was not a very long time. But in about 1 month, I understood the simplest. How can I simplify the very complex movements? That means you need to pay attention only a fraction of the elements and try to understand how it's moved. And after that, the next step is to find movements that is only a few number of elements are changing in position. So, and after that, you can handle this and so on and so forth. But there are so many further potentials, but I don't want to go on. Okay.
And finally, for Mr. Rubik, he talked about his early interest in math, especially geometry, which is something I, for one, can relate to, it being a part of what led me down the path of communication arts or visual arts, however you wish to describe it, as well. So let's hear what Mr. Rubik has to say here.
Naturally, the basic question, what math means, what is the definition of math? So my interest from childhood, when I started to go to school and so on, inside math, I was very interested about geometry. The geometry, there is the visual elements of it. I was interested about art as well, and you know, art and visual appearance and geometry are very close to each other, and that's one thing. But naturally, I have some knowledge and some interest about math. I was probably the best in math in my class, but it doesn't meant I wanted to become a mathematician. So math for me was a too dry or abstract phenomenon. So I liked all the time materials, what you can touch, you can see, you can smell, and so on, so the real life. So, and that's why I studied painting, sculpturing, architecture, design, so to do something, and these are the useful partly, and it has beauty and art is a very important component of it. When the 80s, it became so strong. I remember with I think Time has a yearly publication about the year, and I was there, and they asked me about something, and I said, for me, the cube is a piece of art. And nice. Still now, I feel this way. A piece of art and something else at the same time. So it's a very complex object, but I like the beauty of the geometry, the clarity of geometry, the clarity that is speaks about perfections without knowing we are not able to reach it. You know, that's a big contradiction, but I love contradictions, so I think it's a very important part of our life and way of thinking.
And thank you, Mr. Rubik. I say so because in that clip, he gave us the perfect pivoting point, specifically by using the word art. Walter Pater has been known to have said, quote, all art constantly aspires towards the condition of music, unquote. And I included that quote because it adjoins and extends this presentation towards the next creative person we will be focusing upon. Now, before I go any further, I realize that Wikipedia assuredly is not the best choice as a primary or exclusive reference source. Nevertheless, for some basic information, it suffices. So, taken from the Wikipedia entry concerning him, Robert Moog, spelled M-O-O-G, was an American engineer and electronic music pioneer. He was the founder of the synthesizer manufacturer Moog Music, and the inventor of the first commercial synthesizer. The Moog synthesizer which debuted in 1964. In 1970, Moog released a more portable model, the Mini Moog, described as the most famous and influential synthesizer in history. So much so, there exists a documentary about him. It was released in 2004, entitled Moog. Once again, that's spelled M-O-O-G. A lot of people say it Moog, but the proper pronunciation is Moog. And I'm going to get into the Dutch pronunciation of his family name. That's too complicated. But moving on. To further emphasize the topic of this presentation, let's listen to Mr. Moog discuss his influential creation right from his own workshop.
If this were a digital keyboard, in other words, if the sound were made digitally, what we would have in here would be one very large microprocessor, like a computer microprocessor, and one very large memory. And then all the sounds would be in a form of numbers in that memory. If you press a key, those numbers would come out and be converted into sound waves. That's if this were a digital instrument, which is not. This is an analog instrument. So we have electronic components actually making the electrical vibrations in the sound path of this. There are no numbers. They're all electrical vibrations, which are the analog of things like strings and wood and brass. So this big board here is where the sound is made. And appropriately enough, we call it the analog board. There are a lot of parts on here. There are over 800 parts. I have one over here that I can show you a little bit more closely. Each section of this board here corresponds to one section of the front panel. And these are called connectors here, bring in the electrical signals that tell the analog circuitry what pitch to go at, when to start a note and when to stop it, and so on. And these little blue adjustments here are the tuning adjustments. There are 21 or 22 of them on this board, and they all have to be set just right, as they would have to be in any musical instrument. When I think of this circuit, I have a feeling for what's happening with the electricity as it goes through these parts. You know, I don't imagine resistors being stretched out on a row like this, because that has nothing to do with the sound. What it has to do with is all these little traces on the board here that connect it together and cause the current to change as it goes from one part to the other. So I have a feeling which is very similar to how I imagine a violin maker feels when he's just getting the right amount of wood in one surface of the violin. There are a lot of people who begin to feel what the circuits do in a way that's similar to the way I feel them. Now, I have technical training, so I visualize things more in terms of voltages and currents, but you can also visualize them in terms of how the sound is changing. And I know for a fact that musicians make contact with this board inside the instrument here. Not physical contact. It's not like they have it under their arms, but there's something going around here that connects what's going here with what's going inside here. It's not spiritual in the sense that it's religious, but it's spiritual in the sense that it uses some way of connecting what's in the things that are in the universe by ways other than directly with ours that we can see with our senses.
Notice how he called his device an analog device, not a digital device. And he was quite correct in doing so, as we learned from Mr. Moog, that electricity is flowing through a circuit, and it's that actually generates a sound at the end of the process, as you heard him say, as opposed to just zeros and ones. I liked how he talked about how some musicians at least can sense that electricity flowing through the circuit, a sense that is derived further than just our mere five senses, something that pertains to the divine. And for a Bible-based perspective on this, I'd brush the dust off and pull out Jeremiah 23, verses 23-24. Quote, "I am a God who is everywhere and not in one place," unquote. To which the third person and final focus of this presentation concerning inventiveness and creativity will highlight a very talented composer whom I would say has that extrasensory ability to express the timeless nature of the divine. As for now, let us hear how Mr. Moog reflect upon the process of how his invention came about.
In retrospect, it looks like it was meant to happen. I was building and selling theremin kits. Because of that, I met Herb Deutsch, who was a musician using the theremin in his music classes. Because we met, he invited me to his concert. Because I went to his concert, I learned about electronic music. Because Herb and I got together and talked about making electronic music, I got some ideas for the synthesizer. Because I got some ideas for the synthesizer, we built the equipment. We showed it to one person who then told an official of the Audio Engineering Society about it, and I was invited to display the equipment. And my favorite way of saying it is that I got into the electronic musical instrument business like slipping backwards on a banana peel. Just, one easy thing after another, and there I was. And it looks like a logical progression today, but back then it was, if I do this, then let's see what happens.
Indeed, a major component to this curious mindset is to try new things, to experiment. And I like how I think in all of what we're going to hear, there's little snippets of these folks talking about their a little bit about their childhood experiences and what influenced them, which is very important for all of us with a creative mindset, yes or no. The secret societies know this. The first 6 years of an individual's life are the most important years of their lives because they'll have the foundation to build off of that, a good foundation, or B, they're going to have to undo the damage from an improper foundation. And when that happens, how that happens in their lives varies. So All of which is a perfect segue into what I want to say about how it's unfortunate that there are those who don't necessarily have the means or the time or a tranquil enough upbringing to be able to fully realize themselves, which is a tragedy for the experience of all of mankind as a whole. But I'll touch upon that again later. In my research, I've also noted a few other concurrent elements with all these people, and that being that they definitely spent a great deal of time playing outdoors, getting back to the topic of their early childhood, such as in wooded areas in their youth, and to have had the opportunity to commune with nature. To take a bit of a more of a tangent here with you, with the youth today, I find that that experience has been completely eroded away, especially for those children in urban environments. And over the decades, I've noticed that they fixate now on their mobile devices and play. They play all right. They play in a digital environment, unaware to the overseers watching them from the shadows. So I would hope that you fathers and mothers and grandmothers and grandfathers out there, you should take note of this. Another element these inventors seem to share is that they like experimenting with tangible materials and working with their hands, as we will hear Mr. Moog discuss this and more from his garden.
Here's a sweet pepper. This one is turning from yellow to red. And here's another sweet pepper, a completely different kind, turning from green to red. I've always liked gardening, even as a small child, and my father did too. He was an engineer. Gardening, of course, puts you in touch with nature, growing things requires that you get in tune with nature. What all this has to do with inventing, I'm not quite sure, but somehow they all feel like the same thing to me. Both my wife and I have the view of our universe, of the environment we're in here, as a very complex ecosystem that has to be taken care of, just like a finely tuned machine. This is an organic garden here. We grow our own food. We know exactly what nutrients we put in the soil and what poisons we don't put in the soil. So we feel that we're controlling our own personal environment, our own personal ecology, by having the garden.
In Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 through 28, God did give man dominion over the earth, but not domination over it. That is to say, to exploit it without disregard for the consequences. You don't have to be one of those green religion, false religion, useful idiots for the oligarchy cult members to see that as well. And I'm glad Mr. Moog commented upon the fact that he and his wife's sensitivity towards nature, or God's creation, in that clip. The effects of technology upon the world, let alone on our inner world, with the invention of such synthesizers as what Mr. Moog created, is what we are going to hear about in the next clip.
Back then, anything that didn't come out of wood or a brass instrument or from a string was considered somehow suspect at least, and downright harmful at best. People were very suspicious of electronic instruments producing musical sounds. Before the release of Switched on Bach, which was the end of 1968, not much music had been made with electronic instruments. People heard lots of funny sounds. They heard the sounds in television and radio commercials. Perhaps they heard the sounds in experimental music, which was very very strange to most people. But what Switched-On Bach did was prove that you could make real music that had widespread appeal with these instruments. And I think that was the first really big shift in people's perception of synthesizer and the whole electronic music medium. Then, of course, when rock musicians like Keith Emerson and Rick Wakeman, Jan Hammer began playing, then suddenly it's clearly a human activity. And I think the idea that it was something dangerous and fake and nasty, that died away. It's very easy these days to have an electronic instrument make a sound like wow type sound. Very popular. When these sorts of sounds were first being heard by the general public, people were freaking out. It was the same sort of reaction that we think of primitive cultures having, that a photographer might steal your spirit. And I guess that's what that interviewer at the Musical Society meant by feeling guilty. You know, that, you know, part of it is you're destroying music. You're destroying human culture as we know it today.
So to comment on what we had just heard, it can be quite stunning to hear of inventors and or creators encountering resistance for what they have produced, specifically as emerging technologies appear. In this instance, I think there is a certain logic to that line of thought, wherever it stems from. As I had highlighted earlier, Mr. Moog's invention is an electric instrument, not a digital one. But one could argue that such inventions, such as what Mr. Moog created, were just a stepping stone to the digital age we now find ourselves in collectively. Evidently, what mankind devises to better his condition, such as harnessing the power of electricity itself, I for one can't or won't advocate for going back to a time without such advances. Yet, with such emerging technologies as gene editing and advanced algorithms mistakenly referred to as artificial intelligence, you know, I have to think, you know, where's all this going? I suppose the Book of Revelation gives us the answer to that. Perhaps the issues of concern don't come directly from the technology itself, but rather it comes from the moral foundation of the people using the technology, or lack thereof. And I'll include a verse from Isaiah 10, verse 15. Quote, "Shall the axe boast itself against him that heweth therewith? Or shall the saw magnify itself against him that shaketh it? As if the rod should shake itself against them that lift it up? Or as if the staff should lift up itself, as if it were no wood?" Unquote. All of which being a word of caution against the foolhardy pride and arrogance of possessing, such technologies. Some say there is no such thing as free will. I don't believe that to be the case at all. I think all we have in this life is our free will choice. You know, we control our thoughts and actions and words. No matter what trials we have been exposed to in our personal lives, you know, it is each person's choice as to what paths in life to take. In spite of the influences, or despite of the influences. So, like, on a personal note, sure, even I've made some unhealthy choices in regards to using new technologies, such as the so-called smartphone. You know, these devices certainly had the potential to become like an addiction in terms of overusage. Anyways, returning to the topic at hand, Mr. Moog's remarkable invention did put some musicians out of work. Those that made music for commercials especially, and this was discussed in this 2004 documentary at one point. As for Mr. Moog's invention destroying culture and destroying music, now, there may be some truth to that. However, I'd like to focus the concluding segment of this presentation upon a musician and composer who would come to utilize such technologies in a significantly transcendent way. Born as Evangelos Odysseas Papathanasiou, he is better known to the world by his stage name, Vangelis. And we just heard a short excerpt from the tune Heaven and Hell, Part 1. Vangelis used a few Moog synthesizers in his musical oeuvre, post-World War II, pre-World War III artist is concerned, he is definitely one of my all-time favorites from any medium. And in my opinion, he is an artist. And I found a collection of interviews that he gave in 2008 that we will be listening to shortly. But first, a few tidbits of information from the Wikipedia entry about him. He was a Greek keyboardist, composer, and producer of electronic, progressive, ambient, and classical orchestral music. Although he began playing piano at 4 years old, he has never been able to read or write music on paper. When he was 6, his parents enrolled him in an Athens music school. Soon he performed his first concert of his own compositions. Despite his love for music, Vangelis despised being schooled in the art. Quote, "When the teachers asked me to play something, I would pretend that I was reading it and play from memory," unquote. Vangelis said in an interview for Time Life magazine, quote, "I didn't fool them, but I didn't care," unquote. Now, moving on from that Wikipedia entry, I have found in my own research over the years that many noteworthy artists in their respective medium are usually self-taught. Vangelis was quite a prolific artist. Apart from his official recordings, there's a great deal of superb bootleg material to be found out there, as well as countless never-before-released works. And I've always wondered as to why there still exists a great deal of unreleased material. Obviously, there are I suppose, contract conditions to think of when it comes to the music business, so-called. Sometimes I wonder, though, like, is it a case of that the powers that shouldn't be have assessed that some of his work is too good, too uplifting? But all of that would be pure speculation on my part. If I can be so bold as to make a recommendation concerning his output, as far as his solo work is concerned, I'd say his golden era was from 1973 to 1990, be it his in-studio work or some of the many soundtracks that he had created. And one impetus that prompted me to bring him to your attention is that, as I said earlier, he's like an artist's artist. And I hope you will be able to glean that from the clips from this rare series of interviews, candid interviews, 4 hours in their totality. And at the top of this first clip, he briefly comments upon the fact that he rarely gave interviews. As well, he also discusses the controversy surrounding electronic musical instruments in general.
Something that I said it, you know, the few interviews that I gave in my life, is that although the natural sounds are these sounds, and then even we included all the instruments that the human being produced, like, you know, the flutes, the harps, the violins, the, you know, the percussions and all that, the acoustic, as we call instruments, we call them natural sounds. I still believe that the electronic sounds are equally natural. The only thing that's changed is the source. And somehow, even they go further than the acoustic instruments, because you can produce sounds closer to the sounds of the universe. I mean, human beings express themselves through the acoustic instruments that we know today. But these instruments, they have limitations as well. They don't have limitations of the expression of feeling, but they have limitations of sound. And I guess that's why we produce the symphony orchestra, because it's like the first synthesizer. It's something that we put together the different areas of sound together, and then we create colors and situations between those different families of sound. And then you have the symphony orchestra. Otherwise, why having a symphony orchestra? It was a need to have that in order to enlarge the spectrum. But with the electronic instruments, you go even further than that. And why not? Why they're not natural? I mean, the whole universe is electricity. It's what's the name? It's waves. It's okay. We shouldn't go to that now. But no. So I don't really make the distinction, we say,
yeah,
between the acoustic and electronic instruments, to me, are sources of sound.
So he certainly had made a good argument there in favor of electronic musical instruments when he had said that electricity can be found everywhere. We already covered this topic earlier from hearing Mr. Moog's experience concerning this. However, I wanted to include what Vangelis had to say about this in this presentation, and you'll just have to draw your own conclusions from there. Fortunately, we have an upcoming lengthy clip where Vangelis talks about his creative process, but before we get into that, I wanted to include a few clips that address why I say he is an artist's artist.
But I think you also have to face the fact that, I mean, the music should speak for itself, the painting should speak for themselves. It's impertinent to quiz someone and say, what does that piece of music mean, or what does that painting mean? Because if you knew, you'd write it down in words rather than do it, if you see what
I mean. I don't think I would have done it if I knew. I don't think I would have been able to do it. How do I know? I mean, even knowing, we say knowing. We say, I know this. What do we mean when we say, I know this? We never, we start thinking, in which way you know what you say that you know? And I don't want to go deeper to that, but I mean, again, it's something that, and very, very easy we say, we know, but we don't know. Or maybe what we know, we don't think that we know. It's very complicated. And I'm not trying to be complicated, but through the years, many, many simple things, they become very complicated because we don't mean what we're saying. And we don't say what we mean. And that creates a lot of trouble. A lot of trouble. I mean, we think that a lot of things are necessary, which are totally unnecessary. We spend fortunes on unnecessary things. I remember one thing of, you know, Socrates, which somebody saw Socrates in the marketplace. He says, what are you doing here? They say, you can't imagine how happy I am to see what I don't need. You know? Right. Okay, you see what I mean? But I mean, even you don't have to go as far as that, but I mean, you know, 80% of the things that we've been asked to buy every day, those things are unnecessary. And if we don't buy, we feel insecure because we don't have... You see, it's crazy to feel insecure because you don't have the unnecessary. That's crazy, you think. Once you possess the unnecessary, then you feel secure with unnecessary things. Schizophrenia, isn't it? I mean, that sometimes I do it myself, you know. It's I'm not criticizing anything. I just, you know. Anyway.
I mean, what's fascinating both yesterday and today is to actually talk about music but you started it off yesterday. I was going to say talking about music in a philosophical way.
Mm.
But you quite rightly said, you know, that I'm caricaturing it now, you said it much more eloquently, but there is a music about us, there's a music about our being, there's a music about our souls, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to find a way to communicate that. But it is very unusual to talk about music in purely philosophical terms.
It is unusual because when you have so many centuries that the music became what it became, for the right or the wrong reasons, the music became what it became because the music has been treated like that. And it's been treated because the human beings, through the years, they've been brought up in that way. At least I'm talking about the Western civilization, if you want. You know, there are other countries that they still keep a different approach to music, like India, for example, that they play different music, you know, in the morning, you know, different in the evening, different in the night. And for us, that it's, you know, it sounds quite crazy, I mean, quite unusual. But if deeper we go into the music and the whole mechanism and how it works, we're going to find out that it's something extremely important and quite different from the one that we think it is. Do we want it or not? We are surrounded and covered by music. We're made by music. Now, what we do with music, it's the mirror of our present state. The way that we're treating music, if we know how to read that, immediately we know the state of the human being the moment that you know that this event happens. For example, today we have this music, we put the music down, we don't have to see the people. And by reading this, analyzing this, we know in what situation these people are. The music, it's just, you know, a code. Not a code by itself, but it's another code the moment that the people manufacture music. Because we manufacture music as well. It's not only we made by music, but we manufacture. But we manufacture music in a different way. And this different way, by analyze it, we can see the state of each, you know, period, human beings, you know, civilization and all that. But that's a different different approach, and it needs a lot of maybe seminaries to, you know, to explain.
Well, we're not doing too bad. Yeah. So, I mean, really what you're saying is that if you want to know about a people at a particular time or a civilization at a particular time...
Go to music, to their music.
Yeah, and so the corollary of that is that if you looked around at what... Well, I'm sorry to keep going back to the bouzoukis. If you, as it were, heard the bouzoukis, that tells you a lot about Greek society, which is not anciently truthful.
Let's put it that way. It's not up to me to criticize that, but history in the future will analyze by that music what state was Greece today, or England today, or Spain today, or France today, or maybe 100 years ago, or maybe 500 years ago. And then maybe you can predict in the future what's going to happen, which sometimes today is a little bit difficult to predict because of this uniformity that happens. Because it doesn't allow its country to develop itself. All the influences and the pressures which change the whole situation.
But then it's not a very pretty picture.
Pretty picture? No, I don't think so. No, it's not. It's not because it's false, it's manufactured. That's the problem, is the manufactured thing. And what we do, it's like against the human itself. Because the primary reason is money. How to make money. How to impress and how to make money. Money, 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 money. And the answer, the question is, yes, but how? What are we going to do with that money? Maybe the answer is, maybe we can't, we need. But to monopolize the whole humanity and to put it at the money boot, I think this is something that destroys more than anything else. It's not me to say that. You see around you what's happening. The motivation, even young people, 15 years old, the only thing they want is money. Be famous and money. Now, how to get money, that's another thing. How to be famous is another thing. What do you have to do in order to get that, that's the big thing. True or not?
Well, mankind has been making music for quite some time. And in the past, it was to preserve tradition or preserve memories, perhaps to tell stories that teach moral lessons. I mean, even the Bible has the Book of Psalms. And to tweak and extend what Vangelis had said just there, this manufactured pop culture has a goal in mind. I'd add that the evil that rules this world understands full well mankind's innate attribute to express itself with music, and that they invert this and use it as a weapon of subversion and demoralization. They are also keenly aware that in these times most folks, especially in the so-called West, aren't Bible wisdom literate. Hence, because of this, most people have no firewall, so to speak, to be able to protect their minds from such subversive suggestions coming at them by this manufactured media. A result of this lack of knowledge in the aggregate of Western society is that is the society we see around us today. And I'll go one step further and add that Vangelis himself most certainly participated in these acts of subversion for his own gain to self-finance his own projects. But I think in a way he is trying to redeem himself a bit here with that, from what he states in these interviews. But we're going to get more about that from him later. To conclude this line of speculation, perhaps as a preventative measure, that could be the reason why he didn't agree to be interviewed much beforehand, for fear he would say something that would jeopardize his ability to sustain himself and his projects. To make, quote, money, unquote, as he put it, the context being with one's talent, I suppose. And I want to offer a counterpoint to something he had said, quote, what are we going to do without money that maybe we can't, that we need it, unquote. The scriptures are quite clear about what the belief on money brings about ultimately. And one day we won't need this, quote, money, unquote. One day everything everyone does will be out of compassion, charity, and forgiveness, from you to others as from others to you, and not derived from any ist or ism either, but rather born from a natural, you know, sense of tranquility and harmony amongst mankind. I don't know when this will occur, but occur it will. The tyranny of the oppression of this, quote, boot, unquote, as he had said, you know, the world would be much better off without it, to be free of the belief forward slash love of money, so-called. Well, you can discover more about that in 1 Timothy 6:10. Anyway, next, or ensuite, as the French might say.
But the thing that is absolutely despicable and unforgivable about present society is the cult of the personality, the desire to be famous. It's not famous for 15 minutes. I mean, look at these ridiculous reality shows on television, you know, Big Brother and all that. I'm sure they're terribly nice people, but they're put in a situation that's completely artificial. They do it in order to become famous. Now, I mean, how worth it? They have no... They're only famous for being famous. Paris Hilton, take an obvious example.
Okay,
I mean, that is A, despicable in my book, but also, I mean, that's the end of any real value about the human personality, it seems to me.
But this is the point, the end of the real value. And we have to do, we have to achieve the end of the real value. Because then we can rule in a much easier way. The thing is that...
Sorry, what do you mean by that?
By destroying all that, then you can rule the masses better, easier. The thing is that it's the vicious circle, because the education, I mean, we are educated by the television and by the, you know, the medias and all that, in order to like and to accept that. Most of the things we like today, as we said before, are unnecessary. So what you don't like, you said you don't like this, you don't like that, and that's terrible, is that what has been promoted for years. I mean, a kid today, 10 or 15 years old, I mean, or even before that, 8 or 5, what they watch on television, this, what they want to become stars. They don't know what that is. And it's a very, very immoral. In one hand, of course, what you have two big factors. The one is the vanity, which comes from the artistic side, if you want the artist between brackets. And the greed, which comes from the business side. Now, vanity and greed, they're so, you know, they really like brothers and sisters, like lovers. They love each other. Put vanity and greed, and you become really famous. And the vanity is provided by the artistic side, and the greed is provided by the business side. And they agree totally. And that's why, I mean, whatever big you agree or disagree, is the reason that happens. And the reason that happens is because people lack it. And then you can't fight that. I mean, that's why I'm saying is to go out and say, what you're doing is wrong. Even if it's wrong, the moment that they lack it, well, what are you going to say? In a democratic way, which I'm great, you know, right? And democracy is very important, is wrong. I mean, because, I mean, democracy says this. I mean, you know, and if, you know, the people want that, they want this. Maybe they're wrong, you know, but How you can stop this? You can stop it, of course, with education. The only way is education. But the education, again, it's somehow geared. It's arranged in order to bring those kind of things. Because it's the wrong education, although they pretend it's right education. But that is an enormous issue that we can't go now. I mean, it's not the type of discussion. But the only remedy is education. It's not to stop things and not to permit things and not to ban things and to censorship and all that. That's even worse. It's not to have the need to do that. How you can educate people not to smoke? You can't. It's just the people not to have the need to smoke. For instance, without saying smoke is good or bad. Of course we know for the health is bad and it's ridiculous. See people smoking, for example, after maybe 100 years in film, you say, what are they doing? It's just they got fire. Yeah, it's bad. It's been promoted and promoted and promoted for years because, and of course, it becomes like a drug. And people like it. And of course, it's, you know, I like to smoke a cigar after dinner. That's a different type of thing. Of course, it's not smoking all day. But, and I made the point about smoking, just an example. All the things are like this. And even talking about music, I don't think people are going to like what I'm going to say, but from the 60s, the sex, drugs and rock and roll situation, I mean, which became, you know, just turning point, a social turning point, I don't have to say, you know, the results. You can tell me before I tell you what's happening. Or this incredible marketing that started from England.
I knew it was our fault.
No, it's not a question of fault. How many mediocre guys, I mean, you know, became famous by selling nothing and give the example to kids in order. You know, they're old now and they're doing exactly the ridiculous same thing. But I mean, you know, the kids, where they have to do something, to react. And, you know, they I don't want to go into details, things that I lived because, you know, I spent a long time in England. But I mean, you know, it's madness what's happening. In order to impress, to influence, to impose and to make money. And most of these guys in these groups that don't have money, I mean, some other people that have the money, you know that as well. And through that, it's drugs, it's the way of the behavior, everything. And I'm saying, I'm not judging anything, but we complain, everybody does, that things don't go the way that they should go. And I'm asking, I mean, why they don't go? Maybe this is one of the reasons that they don't go, because you see a kind of, through the music, with this behavior, it's a kind of education as well. You educate the kids when you go to a concert. You educate the kids when you make a film. You educate when you make a television program. And you semi-educate anymore the kids when you go to school. The families are already contaminated. So you see, we're going through the unpleasant stuff again. And,
No, I don't think. I mean, I know you feel that, and I don't feel this at all. Because, I mean, the world of television has the same problem, which it cannot seem to want to resolve. Than when you were talking about music, I mean, the arts on television have certainly diminished to the extent that, as it were, personality shows have increased. So that all television, I mean, the people who run the television, who make money from the ads, all they are interested in is, oh, let's have these meaningless, vacuous, pointless personality exercises. So that television no longer occupies the position of helping towards an understanding or helping towards an education that it did, certainly when I started. It's now an uphill struggle to get that kind of material onto television because it prefers, as it were, Big Brother. I'm just using Big Brother as an example. So, I mean, it isn't only the music world which is forced.
No, it's everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's another, you know, it's one phrase that I totally disagree because it's so easy to come out. Because when we say things and we complain or criticize, you know, certain things, and on television and music or any kind of area, they say, but we give people what they want. And I think it's totally immoral and wrong to say that because we push people and we educate people to give them what we want. But it appears that this is what people want, which actually in the end maybe this is what they want, but in order to get there, to want this, they didn't get there alone. Somebody worked and pushed in order to form a kind of public which you can sell rubbish. And this rubbish, it's something which is unhealthy, which doesn't make the human being better. Because after all, what is the purpose of art? To make people better, not some other another silly phrase that people say, represent or I'm, inspired by my, you know, the current situation, the problems of things. I mean, what's better to express that the television and the newspapers? Better than any artist in the world. The artist is there to give something which is timeless and to make you feel better and to cure all the, you know, to clean you like a filter from all the bad things and let the other stuff to do, to talk about the current things. I'm expressing, you know, my time. So if, you know, you have people killing, then you kill.
So I'm going to nitpick a bit at what he had stated there. His comment about being of Greek extraction and democracy being important to him because of that, well, I'd hope that he would have been more familiar with Plato's five regimes, to which democracy is number 4 out of 5 on that list, downward spiraling towards number 5. Number 5 in this case being tyranny. Vangelis used the word, quote, educate, unquote, in that clip. And in an advocative manner, I'd correct him, and I'd say a better word there might have been indoctrinate. Indoctrination, not being a negative thing in and of itself, it depends, you know, what the influence is occurring by way of the indoctrination. Another impetus as to why I wanted to conclude this these series of interviews, these nuggets of wisdom from Vangelis speaking his mind, has a lot to do with what we just heard. In a way, I just wanted to underscore what he had said there. You see, in the past, I don't know, I'd say 10 years or so, I've been asked on quite a few occasions to give advice on how to start a career in the arts or visual arts, especially from mothers and fathers with such creatively oriented children. In fact, recently on one occasion when I was helping folks out with their tech diffs, in conversation with a mother and her daughter, I was to learn that this woman's 10-year-old daughter had quite a great deal of interest in pursuing such a career. I was flattered that they had asked, but on the other hand, I was wondering if I was the right person to ask. I told them that if you're an artist or a creative person, it's something that you have an innate desire to do and that you'll just do it. To make a career of it depends on a wide variety of factors. I mean, yes, there is something to be said for talent. There are many talented people. Of course, then there is the dedication to your artistic practice. As Vangelis himself stated in the previous clip, quote, what you have to do in order to get that, you know, that's the big thing, unquote. You know, it's somewhat distasteful things one has to do, perhaps. Then as well, there's being born to the right family sure helps. A well-connected one, with the right blood perhaps, along the lines of something like the bloodlines of the Illuminati. It's a real thing, folks. But even after all that, there are traps associated with gaining such notoriety. And for example, people will expect you to do the same thing over and over for what garnered you such attention in the first place. I suppose it depends on what one wants for one's life. I was to advise this mother and daughter that I had spoken to, and I can't help but think of all the talented people out there who could have had a career in such fields of endeavor, but maybe possibly knew better and did not want to participate in all that comes with it, you know, just to keep what they do as being private. Even as Vangelis said so himself, much like I had said in DRAW RLM 002, if you want to be, quote, successful, unquote, in the arts, you have to project the message that the producers or financial backers want to have imposed on the populace, which is usually a promotion of that which would otherwise be deemed unhealthy, immoral, and ignorant, to, quote, contaminate, unquote, them, as Vangelis had said just there. And it's never been clearer today that that is what the powers and principalities that seek the destruction of all of mankind want to have projected outward upon the masses, be it in a subtle or not so subtle way, you know, with influential messages contained within the works produced. You know, I could offer you a myriad of examples of evidence supporting my claim to that. However, I wouldn't want to inadvertently promote such material, nor would it be a fruitful endeavor, since there already are a few others who have already done so. I'll put it to you another way. It would be like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic as it's sinking. And I relayed most of this to this young lady, and I encouraged her to find a fulfilling career path that would give her the means to pursue her artistic pursuits as a personal endeavor, perhaps, as well as to choose wisely about what her art is about, to research the original reasons why mankind practiced such creative endeavors in the first place, much like I had mentioned earlier. And that's another reason why I wanted to focus upon Vangelis, is that most of his music is instrumental. There's no lyrics. There's no ungodly, you know, negative, unhealthy, influential lyrics contained within it. And that's something I appreciate personally. Anyway, to round out this presentation on inventiveness and creativity, I have two more clips for you from this four-hour-long set of interviews with Vangelis. And in the next rather lengthy clip, Vangelis is going to delve deeper into his creative process. I myself and many other talented folks I know personally or know about certainly share the same habits and reasoning that he is about to elucidate further upon.
I mean, for us from the outside, or for me from the outside, you have a completely spontaneous way of approaching of answering a project, of dealing with a project. I mean, it seems to be absolutely instinctive and absolutely spontaneous, and I'm sure that's what gives it its special quality. That must be a nightmare for, you know, what film producers, I mean, producers are like, the David Putnams of this world. They're not good at dealing with spontaneity.
Look, to me, you have to define what we call a project. I mean, to me, everything that I'm doing is a project. A project is not only when we frame something with, and we call it, you know, an album, as we call it, or we call it, you know, a soundtrack, or ballet, or music for a play. I mean, this we call project. For me, everything I do is a project. And I don't need a record company's contract in order to record something. And I don't need a film in order to create music or piece of music. I do it anyway. And I find out that the periods that I was out of a contract, I worked really in a much better way. Now, as I do that, you know, since day one again, it's not something strange or unusual for me to work every day or almost every day without thinking that this is for that particular project or another project. Same thing with painting. I paint all my years and never thought to exhibit. Normally people, they prepare the exhibition, or a singer prepares his new album, or, you know, it happens like that in this business. With me, no. It happens every day. Even if I don't have any, let's call it commission, that comes from outside. Usually my commissions, they come from above. Let's call it that way. And, you know, I'm always plugged there, and, you know, any time, night or day, I'm just operating. As I said before, I'm available. But at the other hand, when I'm committed to something, when I say yes, I will stay until the end in a quite professional way, because that's a different thing. Because you're committed, you work with other people, and you have to take the part of the responsibility that has been given to you. But other than that, I like to work any moment, any time, anywhere, without thinking that this is a particular project or a particular commission, because this is the way that I function.
Do you have any regrets about things? I mean, not particular projects, but I mean, you seem, once one,
yeah,
just peeks inside the door,
mm-hmm,
of your family, yeah, you know, you seem a wonderfully, if I say contented, that sounds like complacent. I don't mean complacent, I mean contented, at peace, yeah, with yourself. And
I mean, regrets of something or...
Well, yes, no, I wasn't thinking of any particular project. I mean, it's very rare to meet someone who is as successful as you are. He doesn't really want to know about that success, except registering it on the scale, as it were. But also, at the same time, is very, very content, and I don't mean by that complacent. I mean, at peace with himself and his immediate environment.
Well, I can't say that I'm content with my career, what we call career, because, let's face it, I mean, nothing is easy. And it's not a question easy to be successful, not being successful. It's to deal with this, the, you know, music business. Already music business is a term which holds a lot of problem, business. So, although I tried very hard to keep a part of freedom and to do certain things and not to repeat myself within this frame, nevertheless, it's a frame, and that frame can squeeze you, because more successful you become, the tighter becomes, because they push you somehow to stay the same and to produce the same successful past. And this is something that I found it very difficult to deal. And I'm not very happy with my career, if you want, because I had many other things to propose and to release, but I've been always restricted to certain things because of the success. because of the sales. So, and you know, everything in life, you have to be in boxes. I mean, at the beginning when I start to make my first albums, which, you know, they started completely against the flow of the time, the record shops, they didn't know where to put my album, in which box, because you know that they have boxes. Then gradually, when I passed the fourth or fifth album, then I had my own box. It's Vangelis, and then you had the whole. And then, you know, when I started with the film scores, that was difficult because that goes to another box. So you had movies, Vangelis, you know, Vangelis as Vangelis, and then you had, you know, we had New Age. Then immediately they find out that the albums that I was making, they belong to the New Age. I mean, this is, you know, the marketing titles that, you know, some very clever people, they always, you know, invent in order to frame the whole thing. So you had New Age, you had film scores, you had Vangelis and whatever, I don't know what. And then, you know, I end up being, you know, in different boxes again, but always boxes. And I was trying, although, you know, the boxes multiply, I was trying to get out of the boxes and maybe to create another box, you know what I mean? And that was, you know, the big problem, you know, with my career. And still, if you ask me today, I believe that I've done nothing except a few successful albums. But this is, compared to what I record every day, this is nothing. I'm not saying that what I've done is bad, what I didn't release is good. What I'm saying is that there are things quite different. And my one of the very difficult moments during, you know, few interviews that I gave in my life, and some people that they ask me, what is your latest work? Or when I release an album, say, oh, I love your latest work. And to me, this latest work, it's really so old, because since then, I compose another 20 or 30 like that, like new works, I'm saying. Then, although I have to play the game saying thank you very much, and this is the latest, it's not the latest. Because usually when you have a new album of a singer and the heavy promotion is going behind, it is really, literally, the latest work. But for me, when is the latest work? I don't know. Before this conversation, I composed something, and after this conversation, I will compose something else. What is my latest? The next one, and maybe tomorrow another one. So I had to deal with all this kind of preconceived things, ideas. I like the idea of an album, or the idea of a single, or a group, or all that, because there are devices that help the business in order to promote and to sell what they call the product. And it's very, very difficult to get used to this idea the moment that you start in a completely different way. A market doesn't exist, an album doesn't exist, a single doesn't exist, you know, just music. And the motivation to make the music is completely different. Because what is the motivation to make an album today? We make a group, we make an album, we make a promotion, we make money. Clean, clear. Right? And everybody's happy. I hope they're happy. But with me, it never happened like that. Although I went through this game, but it was not my game. And again, you know, if you ask me why I've done that, it's because I didn't have any other choice to support all the things I wanted to do. All the demands that the sound is the most demanding thing. Music is the most demanding thing. Absolutely. I mean, it's in one hand is fulfilling and fascinating, and the other thing is crash you down, because it wants, the music wants you. And especially in my case, I wanted all this incredible equipment, because I'm working in a quite electronic way. Acoustic and electronic, of course, but then you have to build all that. And if you don't have, you know, then at the time to have your own studio was a big thing. Today, of course, technology allows you to have, even with one laptop, people that can do something. I mean, they call it single, or they call it production, they call it album, whatever. Then you had to have a proper studio, big studio, which I did. And I still do, everywhere in the world. I go and just build something. And I carry all the equipments with me, and I have other equipments, you know, in London, in Paris, in Athens, and, you know, I find out myself in Los Angeles, you know, having a studio in my place, you know, in New York, in my hotel, in Rome, I made an album in a hotel. Always have, you know, tons and tons of things. So all that costs money. And I have to take care of those kind of things, because nobody will pay for that, except myself, and I'm proud for that. Because then I keep my independence and my dignity. That's another spin. Okay? Mm-hmm. That's a spin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
It was a kind of throwaway line, but it's such an important idea. I want to not quite throw it away. When you said music makes a demand, is a demanding mistress. You didn't use that phrase, but I mean, you may say,
well,
music,
I can say it makes
demands.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Try to be at the level and the importance of music, and once that you realize what music means and you respect that, immediately it becomes very demanding. Music is not a joke. It's a very serious thing. Serious thing doesn't mean serious in a way, you know, serious. You can laugh, I mean, you can... But you have to be always there. You have to be ready. You have to... I mean... I spend hours and hours and hours with all this system, my system, all that I create around. It needs a lot of practice. I play hours. These fingers, they've done, you know, miles and miles every day. And it's not only that, it's the connection between my brain, my fingers, my whole body. I work like an athlete. It doesn't come, you know, in that sense easy. Because all that should come through the body, which is another machine, and you have to develop the technique in order to the most difficult thing to appear very easy, not to appear to others, mm-hmm. but to be able to obtain the immediate result. And all the musicians. Especially the soloists and all that, they will understand that because they spend hours practicing. So, in one hand, of course, I'm spontaneous. In the other hand, I practice a lot. Every day in my life. Night and day. I don't want to sound boring, but, you know, you can't do without spending, you know, three-quarters of your life in order to come to the standard, to reach, to go as close as possible to music. That's why I'm saying it's very demanding. And then, of course, the wonder of music. the vastness, the possibilities of music, the power of music. Something that is so amazing and beautiful can sometimes, you know, tire you and can drives you crazy as much as something that is not. Music works both ways. See, oh, he says, that's so beautiful, I can't stand that beauty anymore. That happened to you to say that, no? To everybody. So when you live with something, with this, with music, and with painting, of course, because when you are in front of something empty, there are two ways. Or you leave it empty, and then you ask a lot of money for the emptiness. Yeah. Or you invade this emptiness, either with something that's worth the trouble to do it, or with nonsense. But the question is there: what you're going to do? And it's not nobody puts you in that situation. You put yourself in that situation. Now, why you do that? That's another discussion, maybe another moment, but the thing is that it happens. So all these things are very demanding. The people, they take only the successful part, the success, the awards, the sales, the, you know, decorations and all that, and bravos, and all that is a very tiny moment, which most of the times, you know, creates you more problems than other things. But the real struggle is what you don't see. How many times have I spent sitting there and playing? And I learn every day more and more. Because sometimes when I do things that I don't understand how I did it. Then I have to go back and say, okay, how I did this? Because most of the times I'm not there. When that happens, I'm there, but I'm not there. So I have to go back, and most of the times when I listen to the music much later, in order to keep the distance and to be as objective as possible, then I realize that there are things that I don't know how they happen. That's very, I mean, to me it's fascinating sometimes. And all that has nothing to do with releasing music, with success. This is a different thing. I'm not saying that referring to in order to value anything, to say that what I'm doing is fantastic. No, it's nothing to do with that. It's just, I try to tell you how it happens and what happened.
I know that was a lengthy clip. I want to thank you all for hanging in there and for this whole presentation, let alone for that clip. But, you know, there's so many important things, I think, that he had to say. I just didn't want to start chopping it all up or to even, you know, not include it at all. That was the whole point of this presentation, was to be able to include these sorts of thinkers, creators, inventors to hear what they have to say in their own words. And speaking of which, I wanted to conclude this presentation with a bit of a hopeful message. I'm well aware that hopium has the potential to be a very dangerous drug. We can't just rest on our laurels and hope for things to change, be it on a societal or even on a personal level. If you want to see changes, you're going to have to make changes. And I'm saying that to myself as well here. So don't think I'm getting up on my high horse here or anything like that. I hope with what I had brought to your attention today, you can better recognize these inventive and creative characteristics in others, especially in the youth of today, for whom, collectively speaking, are our future for tomorrow. So to conclude, Vangelis, you have the floor.
Now, the diagnosis is so important as much as the, what I said before, the to be as much as possible objective. Now, the thing that we don't do is the diagnosis. We don't do the right diagnosis for what's happening. And if you don't do the right diagnosis, we can't treat the symptom. Because what we do here, we're talking about symptoms all the time. This symptom is not good, this symptom doesn't happen like that, this symptom, you know, it's like this. You know, all symptoms. But the causes, in order to find the cause, you have to diagnose the cause. And there is something that people, either they're not able to go, or maybe they don't dare going. And if you don't go to this, it's nothing that can change. And the change is not against no one. The change is only for humanity. It's humanity on stake. It's not one country or another. It's humanity itself on stake. This is how we get, I mean, as far as we get now. And we're not able to realize that. We can't realize somehow the human brain can't realize this. And that is something incredible. But we talk about terrible symptoms. You say, I can't sleep at night, I have pain here in my head, I can't move my head, I have pain in my back. You know? Okay, why? Let's find the why. Nobody does. I mean, and sometimes on television, late at night, have some problems. And then some semi-pseudo-intellectuals, that they say some totally, you know, stupid things. And they go into political things, and they try through that to promote certain other stupid ideas, and then, you know, it gets even worse. And then they mix up the people that they can listen, but fortunately, you know, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, nobody listens, so it's okay. But, you know, the right diagnosis, and as much as it's objective you can be, I think that can lead you somehow somewhere that maybe you can start having a hope.